line with the program, we now have a session for your Dhamma questions. And many of you have written down various questions. So I'll endeavor to read them, translate them, listen to the answer in Thai, for those of you who speak Thai, and then translate back into English. So you need some patience while you're listening to the language. If you don't understand, just quietly meditate. I'm sure Jen's words of wisdom will help us all. So Tanajan was responding to a question asking for him to talk about himself, where he's from, how he came to become a monk, and how he practiced at that time when he first decided to ordain as a monk. So Tanajan was answering, when he was young, a student, his home was fairly near to a very new branch monastery of Ajahn Chah's that they were establishing in central Thailand, a forest monastery. So he had contact with monks, seeing forest monks walking quietly on arms round regularly, sometimes putting food in their bowls. And he also started to have his own questions, and in his own mind started to inquire into the purpose of life and why we're here, what it's all about. He remembers one experience when he was a student. He had a teacher who, like most teachers, sometimes would find the job frustrating, and the students might say or do things which would tempt the teacher to become angry. But he could see this teacher, even though he could see he was tempted to become angry by different situations that would arise in the classroom, he always managed to control himself. He would never actually get angry or give in to his anger. He could do this very well, which gave rise to interest from Ajahn Anand. Why can he do that? What method is he using to control anger in different situations? So he asked the teacher when he had the time, and the teacher said, well, he practiced meditation, Anapanasati, using that method, breathing meditation. So Ajahn Anand became interested as a student to follow along to try practicing some meditation, and he found he got some peace from practicing mindfulness of breathing. He could experience quite peaceful states where the body became very light, the mind became light. He also had other questions arising in his mind, like many of us. Why are we born? What's the purpose of life? Why are we here? And when we die, what happens? Where do we go, or what happens after death, and so on. So this was an ongoing interest for him, interested in his own mind and the state of human mind, and what is peace, true peace and happiness, and the question of how he should live his life to achieve that and find that. Later on, he graduated and got a job at the Siam Cement Company, a very large company in central Thailand, not far from his home, and also again close by to this branch monastery of Ajahn Chah's. And he noticed, as he was working, his mind was sometimes not particularly peaceful with the stress of work and different situations arising. He noticed he might have agitated and disturbed states of mind. And he thought back to that time when he was a student practicing meditation, and thought, maybe he should practice meditation again, because now his mind is not so peaceful. So this led him to go to back to that branch monastery of Ajahn Chah's nearby, and to start studying meditation, practicing it again, sometimes staying there, keeping the 8 precepts, just as you all are today, listening to Dhamma. And he could see that this practice was beneficial for him. He also got to find out a lot more about the Dhamma practice from the monks in that monastery. They told him about many of the great meditation masters living in Thailand, particularly northeast Thailand, disciples of Venerable Ajahn Mun, and he would go and visit them as well to listen to Dhamma. So little by little his faith was becoming firmer and firmer, so he decided to keep the five precepts on a daily basis. And then on the Buddha day, every 7 or 8 days in the lunar cycle, he would go, like other Buddhists, to the monastery and keep the 8 precepts and spend his time in meditation. He wouldn't eat in the evening, so he had more time available for meditation on those days. And one time he was in the monastery and he listened to a talk from the monk, the teacher there, explaining how everything in this world deludes us because we get attached to the conventional reality, what we call samuttisaccha, the conventional reality where we label everything. We say, this is a house, this is a tree, this is, we give labels, names to everything, and we're always caught up in the labels that we give to things, whereas any object or experience in this world is just what it is. It doesn't really know that it's a tree, doesn't know it's a tree, a house doesn't know it's a house. These are just labels that human beings put on. And listening to this talk, it made great sense to him, so his mind gathered together in samadhi, became very peaceful, and he was contemplating in this peaceful state the meaning of the teaching that he was listening to. And his view of things started to change at that point, and he started to see that really physical phenomena and mental phenomena are impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self, without an owner. What we say is anicca, dukkha, anatta. And he could have different reflections arising, different nimittas and experiences arising at that time when his samadhi gathered together, his mind was very peaceful. For instance, he had one very clear vision of just seeing all the people around in the town going to work, going here, going there, going shopping and so on, but as if all just walking towards their death, towards their grave. Because that's the experience of human beings. We can't stop the process of aging, we can't stop our gradual march towards death at the end of our life. Nothing, we can't do anything about that. So there's a very deep insight into the impermanent nature of this life that we have, this body, this mind. Another one, he could see that it's as if everybody is trapped in a house that's on fire. You know, this body that we have here, it traps us and brings us a lot of suffering. But most people are not even trying to escape from this house that's on fire. They're actually staying in it without realizing it's going to bring them suffering. He had many different reflections like this, which brought great states of joy and peace and equanimity in his mind for many days. And he had the feeling he just wanted to leave the world. He could see that there's no real true lasting happiness to be found in this world, because the nature of this world is impermanent, unsatisfactory and not self. He wanted to find something beyond that, something that was, you might say, a lasting or true happiness. And you could see that it's impossible to really achieve that just with the things of this world, trying to find satisfaction in this world. So that led him on to really keep wanting to practice the Buddhist path, listen to the teachings, put them into practice as a way out of suffering. So after several days of having very states of deep peace arising from both samadhi and contemplating the Dhamma, he finally resigned from his job and decided to go forth, to go to the monastery, to train, to take ordination. And he ordained with Ajahn Chah in Wat Bopong, northeast Thailand, who was his teacher, and started to practice in the way of a forest monk, a forest bhikkhu, following the strict observances, keeping the Vinaya, and keeping many of the what we call the Tutonga Watas, the ascetic practices. So eating in the bowl, the alms bowl, putting all the food together in the bowl, whatever the food is, whether it's sweet or curries, fruit, whatever, all goes into the bowl mixed up. Eating just one meal a day, living very simply, practicing contentment with little, and living in quiet, secluded places, practicing the teachings that Ajahn Chah gave. Spending time in cremation grounds or lonely forests and so on. And little by little, his understanding of the Dhamma grew from that time. Another question is, we normally like to dream future events. Is there any method to dream now so that we can live in the present time? Please explain a way to stop dreaming about the future, daydreaming. So Tenajan recommended that if you have the tendency to dream a lot, whether it's daydreaming or in your sleep, practice mindfulness. So before you go to sleep at night, try to prepare yourself with mindfulness. You might bow 3 times to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, then do some chanting, Iti Piso Bhagava, the qualities of the Buddha, chanting those or any of the other chants that we do, as a way of establishing mindfulness in the present moment, and focusing on that which is very wholesome, to bring up faith. And then contemplate your life a little bit to see the true nature of things, to see how impermanent your life is. Say, as you're just preparing to go to sleep, you think, well, maybe during the night something might happen. This might be the very last night of my life. Maybe I won't wake up in the morning. It's not that you're wishing that to happen, you're just contemplating to see that's possible. We really don't know which will be the last night of our life. It's uncertain. When you contemplate in this way, it helps to let go of that tendency towards daydreaming, what we call mental proliferation about the future, about things that hasn't happened yet and so on. So it brings your mind back to the present moment. Then spread thoughts of kindness, loving kindness, metta to all beings so that your mind's relaxed and happy. And then keep practicing mindfulness until you fall asleep. So mindfulness on the breath or reciting buddho. People do find they have sometimes very clear dreams, say telling them about events that are going to happen, especially people who meditate. But the important thing is to keep practicing sati, mindfulness. Keep it on its object, on the breath, or on buddho. Yom Tam. Are there disadvantages in following the breath from the tip of the nose to the abdomen and back? Do you advise to keep mindfulness on the tip of the nose? When we're beginning the practice of mindfulness of breathing, Anapanasati, it's okay to follow the whole passage of the breath. You can follow it from as it enters at the tip of the nose, down to the chest, to the abdomen, follow it back up again to the chest and then out at the tip of the nostrils. That's fine. The important thing is to have mindfulness and be aware as the breath is going in, to be aware, and now the breath is coming in. As the breath leaves, to be aware of that and to keep bringing your mindfulness up with the sensation of the breathing. Please explain to me why I often feel warm, heat, while in meditation. Is it good, if, or is it a sign that the body is sick? I believe not clear the question. This is very normal for people meditating as their mind gathers together, as you're focusing on a meditation object and your concentration improves. There's this quality of the mind gathering together, and sometimes this is accompanied by a sense of the body warming up. Or for other people it's actually the opposite and they feel like the body is cooling down. Either can happen. Or you might not notice any particular change in the body temperature, that's also possible. But whatever these kind of feelings are, one doesn't have to worry about them. They don't have any, they won't bring us any harm, and it's not a sign that the body is sick or anything like that. It's just because the mind is settling down and unifying in the course of the practice. He says when the weather is cold like at the moment, then if you're feeling a bit warmer from your meditation, it's probably a good thing. He says many changes start to happen as we practice meditation regularly to the body and the mind. This person has asked about the feeling of the body warming up. Others have this feeling that the body is cooling down, as he said, and obviously if it was cold weather like today and you're feeling the cold weather outside and then also inside you actually have a feeling as though your body is becoming very cool from the meditation, that could be quite challenging. Alternatively, if you were in a hot country like say Thailand or Sri Lanka, and it's very hot, but when your mind gathers in samadhi you feel very cool, well, he said it's like you have your own air conditioning unit, and that's very pleasant. And he says, you know, that feeling of coolness can come up and last a long time. You know, at first it might just be a few moments or a few seconds or minutes, but as you meditate maybe that feeling of coolness will come up. It can last a whole month. You're as if you have your own cool air conditioning unit going the whole time. Your body and mind feel very light, very happy. And these sort of changes come up in the course of meditation. Usually it's gradually. So he says, you know, when you meditate, maybe you try very hard doing your formal meditation, sitting and walking, and maybe you just experience a few moments of peace only when you're meditating. But for someone meditating regularly and maybe for many years and becoming more experienced, perhaps not even just when they're sitting meditation or walking meditation, just doing any other activity like talking or eating, the sense of inner peace and coolness can be coming up quite naturally all the time. Next question. Please tell me, is it unwholesome karma to be a non-vegetarian? If you buy and eat meat without harming animals, is this still participating in the killing of animals?
นักทานกี่คนโยมใครทานมังสวิรัติบ้างนี่ยกมือขึ้นนะเนี่ยทานมังสวิรัติไหมมีไ
หม How many people eat vegetarian?
กินทะเลเยอะไห
ม Put your hand up, vegetarian.
มีเหมือนกันนะ
Tanajan was just explaining karma means intention, or it's the quality of the karma we make, good and bad, is determined by the intention in our heart, in the line behind each action, good or bad. So if you go to a shop where they sell meat and they have meat on display ready to sell, for sale, and you just walk into that shop and you buy meat just to buy food for your family or yourself to eat. You go and cook it. There's no bad, unwholesome intention in your mind. Your intention is just to buy food. But if you went to a shop, say you went to a butcher's and they didn't have any meat, and you said, oh, I need a chicken or some pork or something today, And that would be the cause for them to go and actually slaughter an animal for you to supply you with that meat. Then that would be bad karma because you have the intention to eat meat, and that's, and you've instructed someone to go and get that meat by killing someone. So there's a difference there. Having said that, if you do go to the shops and they have meat available, and you haven't instructed anyone to kill, you're just buying food and you buy that meat. It's important also to just know what is the right amount to eat when you cook a meal for yourself or your family. You learn to eat a modest amount, not to overeat, not to indulge just in, say, taste and the sensual aspect of food too much, but just to eat. Because the purpose of food is really to support us in our Dhamma practice so that we have strength to work and to practice meditation and do what we have to do in our duties. It's not really an end in itself, even though sometimes we get caught up into that. If you do buy meat and things and you want to offer it to monks, that's actually, if a monk knows that you're specifying a dish, like you say, I'm going to make you some pork curry, or I'm going to fry this fish for you, or something, you actually tell the monk what you're going to do with this meat before you've done it, and they say, tomorrow I will offer you this dish of food. If that monk hears those words, the monk actually is not supposed to eat that dish. You're not supposed to specify, you know, types of food that you're going to offer to a monk. And then Tenzin also just mentioned a story, a true story about a nun who was a well-known meditator, had good meditation. And one day she had a vision of a deer, the ghost of a deer, coming to her. And this deer said, I was killed by a hunter, had just been killed that day by a hunter. And tomorrow this hunter is going to bring food to you to offer to support the Sangha. So please, can you dedicate some merit to me, because I'm now dead. This is the ghost speaking in her nimitta, so that I can get a good rebirth. And the nun knew that the hunter hadn't actually planned to kill the deer to offer to the monastery, to the Sangha. He killed it, and then he also, out of habit, would offer food, but he didn't actually specify or plan to kill. So she knew she was allowed to eat the meat. It wasn't breaking the rules. But once she accepted the meat, then she chanted a blessing and spread metta for the ghost of that deer. She's hoping for it to get a good rebirth. And she contemplated the food that she ate that day was just a support for her Dhamma practice. Yeah. Lumpo added the story about the couple in the time of the Buddha, the Lord Buddha. The husband was a hunter. Go out into the jungle every day to trap and kill animals, shoot them with arrows. That was his living. His wife was very dutiful, and she would every day clean his tools and his weapons and set them out ready for him to go off hunting. But the Buddha had told the other villagers that this woman was a sotapanna, and she kept the 5 precepts every day. She wouldn't kill. And they were skeptical because they said, well, how can this be? This woman every day is preparing weapons for her husband to go off and kill. And the Lord Buddha said, true, but her intention is just to be a good wife and support him in what he does, help him out. She doesn't have any intention to actually kill animals. Her intention is just to be a good wife and a friend. And, you know, just shows you that sometimes you have to be able to distinguish in your mind intention and action and what you see on the outside and what's going on the inside. Obviously for that lady to practice like that is very difficult because the husband was killing every day. But she was able to separate in her mind. She was a sotapanna, so she had no intention to kill. She kept the five precepts. And she was able to separate in her mind between what her husband was doing and what she was doing. I think later on they also, the Lord Buddha did manage to teach the husband. One time the hunter went out and he had set a trap, and the Buddha himself came walking through the forest and he found this trap and there was an animal in it. So the Buddha let the animal go. Because he'd done that, he put himself in the trap, put his own foot in the trap instead, because he'd let that animal go. He had to give the hunter something, so he gave him himself. He stayed there. And when the hunter came, he was so angry seeing the Buddha there and realizing the Buddha must have let his trapped animal go, that he raised his bow and arrow and was about to shoot an arrow at the Buddha in anger. Meanwhile, the wife suspected the husband's taking a while, is anything up, so she sent her children after the husband to find out what's going on. And they called to their mother. They went and saw the husband angry and preparing to shoot the Buddha. They called their mother. The mother came, and the kids and the mother, they all said, "Don't shoot, don't shoot." So they knew it was the Buddha. And finally the father's heart was softened hearing his wife and kids saying, "Don't shoot." Normally he was a hunter and he was quite used to shooting. Once his mind became softened, then the Buddha was able to teach him, and he actually became a sotapanna listening to the teachings. So it's all down to intention. So I say something, you might have a doubt. If you drive out from Melbourne, drive here along the country road, you might hit insects on your windscreen and think, "Oh, I'm killing insects here. I'm making bad karma." But again, if you don't have that intention, your intention is just to drive your car to the monastery. It's not to kill insects. You're not actually making bad karma. It's just unfortunate there are insects in the world and they hit the car. There are some sects in India from the old days that practice this, that you might say they've got a very slightly wrong view, where they try to avoid anything, even unintentional killing. So they actually, they have monastics who get carried around on a sedan chair, like they have their students carry them around on a chair so they can't tread on anything and kill anything. But of course the students do kill things, but the monk can say, "Well, I didn't kill anything, I didn't tread on the ground." Ajahn Chah did eat meat sometimes, because that's in northeast Thailand, the culture there, they do tend to eat meat. But just out of interest, the monastery was so poor, like in the days Ajahn Anand lived with Ajahn Chah, there's very little meat offered because people were so poor. Mostly they did offer just fruit and vegetables, the things they could gather up from the forest and the countryside. A question. "Tanajan, it is a pleasure to see you on Waisak Day. I practice meditation every day. I have children. I don't attach to my kids. They're still very young. I do my responsibilities. I show them love and kindness. But in my mind, I always tell me these kids are just little humans, nothing special, not mine. Is it okay?" Well, of course, if you have children, your first reflection should be, "I am a mother, I have children." You can't avoid that, you can't escape from that. Once you have children, you make that decision, or once it happens, that's a truth that we have to accept, and it brings with it responsibility. But you can look at it in terms of Dhamma. Yeah, this is, you might say, the conventional wisdom. You have a mother, father, children, offspring. Obviously, we have karmic connections. If children are born to us, we're a mother and we have children, 1, 2, 3, however many children. That's a sign that we've made karma together and we are making karma together this life. So, and that's a relationship you can't just deny or let go of or overlook. It's true, it's happened, it's there. It exists. So on the surface, the correct thing is always to recognize, well, I'm a mother, I have a responsibility, I must look after these children. They've come, you know, you give birth to children, you're sharing, it's out of your own four elements. You have, your body is earth, air, fire and water. And you actually, you know, you're sharing your own four elements with your child because your child is growing out of your own blood and flesh and blood. So you have that responsibility. But of course, if you are meditating and practicing the Dhamma, you can also reflect on this more deeper level, the level of liberation, where you see, well, ultimately, even this body is the four elements. It's empty of any self or owner. Ultimately, there is no mother, no father, no body, no child. It's just the four elements. But you still have your conventional responsibility to oversee and to manage. So we have to develop the four Brahma Viharas. We have to develop kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity towards our children. We can't just ignore that responsibility. That would be bad karma. That would be incorrect. Our children depend on us for everything, so we have to look after them. And it's a mutual responsibility. You know, we have our responsibility, having brought these children into the world, we do have to see to their needs and their welfare, try to teach them the Dhamma. They also have a duty to look back and reflect on the value of having parents. You know, parents bring us into the world, and to recognize that, not to deny or hide from that fact. And children have a responsibility back to their parents to look after them, to support them also. So these are important dhammas. We can't just sort of dismiss everything and say, well, it's all not self. You also have to practice appropriately according to the conventional reality of the world, a mother, a father, a child, so on. But to keep reflecting on the three characteristics, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and not self. This does help you to not become just blindly attached to your children or overly attached to your children. There are many questions today, and we've already reached our hour, but Tanajan at the moment is willing to carry on, so carry on. We are very fortunate to be with you. Thank you for coming. Please explain briefly, what does the Paticca Samubbada mean? Well, this refers to Paticca Samubbada. In short, refers to the fact that all dhammas arise from a cause. In practical terms, you could reflect this sense of self, the sense of me, a being, a person, arises from a cause. We have sense contact going on all the time through our life, from moment to moment. We see sights, we hear sounds, we taste, we smell, and so on. As we have sense contact, this gives us feeling arising. With feeling is a cause for craving to arise. In practical terms, I like, I don't like. So you have a sense of I, me, myself arising, and you have liking, disliking, and so on. This happens regularly. It becomes attachment, what we call upadana, and feelings of pleasure and pain, happiness, sadness, all those experiences arise out of this causal process where the sense of self keeps forming. Every time we have sense contact, pleasurable, unpleasurable, sense of self arises, we have craving for or against. Going on all the time, it's a cycle. The way to deal with this wisely, skillfully, is to practice mindfulness regularly. Bring up mindfulness and contemplate this process as it's going on, to see through this false sense of self that keeps forming with our sense contact. so that we gradually, little by little, erode away the deluded sense of self, that attachment to a sense of self. Little by little, it will be eroded away through the presence of mindfulness and wisdom, investigating until ultimately we've let go of it completely, and then the cycle of suffering will be broken, we'll have no more suffering. So that's a brief explanation. Tanajan, some of the great monks, their body parts, their blood, hair, bones, become relics. Is the relic a result of the purification of the body part itself? If the answer is yes, how do we purify our own body? Please, could you explain how relics are formed? The body parts of practitioners turn into relics. And this is through the effects of the practice of mindfulness and developing insight, wisdom, through contemplating truth with mindfulness. Practiced regularly over a period of time, it has a purifying effect on the mind. This is a kind, you might say, a kind of energy that develops the mind, the pure energy of the mind as it gradually comes to see the truth and let go of suffering. This is a pure energy that has its effect on the body. Obviously the mind and the body are closely related. And over time this pure energy leaves its effect, leaves its impression on the parts of the body. So it's a process. And if we wish to purify our minds and bodies, well, this is what the practice does. We have to put our effort into the practice of Dhamma. So to develop purity through sila, developing our morality, learning not to harm oneself or others through speech or actions, develop samadhi, the powers of concentration and letting go of unwholesome states of mind, and then to develop the energy of wisdom that will purify our view through developing clear insight into the impermanent, unsatisfactory and ownerless nature of this body and mind. As we develop insight, all aspects of this path, sila, samadhi and panya, then little by little the mind experiences more refined states of happiness as it's gradually purified. And this kind of rubs off or leaves its impression on the body as well. And gradually, as insight deepens, then the body is purified, so eventually the body will turn to relics. When or how do we know that we have reached vipassana samadhi? What is the correct speed of walking meditation? Very slow, slow or medium pace? The answer to that question was, as far as walking meditation goes, the speed you walk at should really be determined by the results you're getting. So if you find walking very slowly, you've become more mindful, your mind settles down and you become more mindful and more peaceful, then that's probably a sign that's good for you. Or if you find walking faster, your mind is more settled, mindfulness arises and is sustained, and that's good for you. It's not fixed for everybody. Some people, when they walk meditation, they also recite the word Buddho as a mantra. And some people find reciting very fast helps them because it cuts through all the different thoughts and moods that normally distract them. So they walk Buddho, 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 and they don't give any space to any other thoughts to arise, and they become peaceful. Other people do it very slowly, so you have to experiment for yourself. As you practice meditation, whether it's sitting or walking, you know, the practice of vipassana, we say, is the clear seeing of the nature of physical and mental phenomena as anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent, unsatisfactory or not self. This has to come out of a mind that is clear enough and peaceful to do that, to be able to see those qualities in the experience. So if you're meditating, your mind is calm, and then thoughts arise, and you can see those thoughts as impermanent, just different objects of mind arising, passing away, well, that's vipassana, isn't it? That's clear seeing of the way those thoughts are, those moods. But if you're trying to watch your mind, practice of vipassana, and you're just caught into endless, agitated, restless thinking all over the place, going everywhere, this is not vipassana yet, is it? It's obviously one needs to calm the mind more so one can see really clearly the nature of phenomena as impermanent, so physical phenomena, mental phenomena as impermanent. So I think that's probably enough for this session, because we've gone on a long time, and I think everyone probably needs to change posture. There's quite a few other questions, so we'll see if we can fit them in at another time, either today or tomorrow.